This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. In May of 2011, a deadly F5 tornado struck Joplin, Missouri, leveling a large swath of the town in the path of destruction. 158 people were killed. Thousands more were injured. And then after a deadly December outbreak of storms we saw last month, many people were looking back to Joplin more than a decade ago. What did we learn? And could deaths like the six people who were killed at the Amazon warehouse facility in Edwardsville, could they have been prevented? Some are saying yes, if the industry had allowed certain safeguards to be put in place. Chris Lavelle is a climate reporter for the New York Times, focusing on how people, governments, and industries try to cope with the effects of global warming. Chris, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
We're also joined by Frank Lombardo, an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. He's former vice chair of the American Society of Civil Engineers Committee and was also part of the team that investigated the structural and environmental conditions after the deadly Joplin, Missouri tornado. Frank, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's get right into it. Chris, what was it about the Joplin, Missouri tornado in 2011 that was unique?
You know, I don't know if it was something that was unique as opposed to just the sheer scale of what happened. Every one of these that leaves people homeless or dead is a travesty and a tragedy, right? But I think something about the scale of Joplin spurred people to say, what can we do differently? And then really what's grabbed me is it looks less like a one-off in hindsight because we have so many of these terrible disasters that there seems to be more attention being spent on answering the question of how can we better protect people.
And Frank, you toured Joplin after the tornado there and you've been back several times. What brought you there in the first place? What did you see?
Yeah, I think similar to what Chris said, it was really the scope. I think we were kind of in a, really before 2011, tornadoes had kind of fallen off the map. There hadn't been, you know, I think the consensus was that, you know, we were doing a good job in reducing fatalities and damages until the 2011 season and especially Joplin. So, you know, when we saw the scale, you know, from TV and in the media, we said, okay, you know, and especially St. John's Hospital in Joplin, which suffered major damage, we decided to go down and really kind of deeply investigate, you know, the hazard characteristics in Joplin and then how the buildings performed.
And what sort of lessons did you take away from there? And I should say we need to take a break, unfortunately, in about a minute. But briefly, what are some of the top line things that you learned in Joplin?
Yeah, I think one is just it kind of highlighted how vulnerable communities were to tornadoes. I think previously we kind of assumed that tornadoes were relatively low risk, and when we saw something like Joplin, we realized that wasn't the case. And then again, I think another thing that we learned is that, you know, tornadoes like this are more common, I think, than what we previously thought. So. It really kind of challenged our initial assumptions and then really kind of led to this detailed 3-year investigation on the tornado.
Okay, we need to take a break. We're going to come back and get more into that investigation, standards for buildings, the idea of safe rooms, as well as the possibility we're facing that we're going to be seeing more of these intense storms and more storms that are more intense, possibly. We're going to be speaking with Chris Lavelle, who's a climate reporter at the New York Times, and Frank Lombardo, professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation, especially if you live in a part of the country that's subject to tornadoes. 800-222-9455. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about how the building industry might have blocked standards that could have saved lives during the Quad State tornado outbreak in December. We're speaking with New York Times reporter Christopher Flavelle, who covers how people and industries are adapting to a changing climate. His recent piece is called How the Building Industry Blocked Tornado Safeguards. And we're also speaking with Frank Lombardo, assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois. He specializes in wind engineering and building resilience. And listeners, we want to hear from you. If you have questions about the recent tornadoes outbreak in December, especially the one that killed six people in Edwardsville, Illinois, or maybe you just have a question about building standards and how we might think about them as it relates to climate change and potentially more frequent storms in parts of the country that maybe had not had to have that sort of hardened weather preparedness that they did in the past, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. So, Chris, who establishes standards for buildings and who's responsible for enforcing those standards?
Sure, it's a great question, and it's not a simple answer. The way building codes work in the U.S. At 30,000 feet is every state has the authority to determine what their state's building codes look like. In some cases, there's a statewide code. In some cases, states then give that authority to local officials so they can decide. But states don't just come up with these codes by themselves. In most cases, they will draw on what are called model building codes and tweak them as desired. Those model building codes are in turn produced by a group called the International Code Council, which is often called just the ICC. And the Code Council every 3 years convenes a gathering of building experts and people in the building industry to talk about how various building codes should be updated as technology improves. So it's a really roundabout process that leads to the building codes that are in effect in most states. And then you asked about enforcing. Enforcing is also very complicated. Usually it's local officials who have authority for making sure that builders follow the rules. Often you get big lobbying fights as some groups try to convince officials to carve out, to remove restrictions that are in those model building codes. So what seems, I think, at first glance, like a very dry topic, building codes, is in fact the subject of immense political wrangling all the time.
And a lot of entry points, it sounds like, for people to try and exert their will, who may have an interest in how those codes are developed and enforced. Chris, let's talk about one of these ideas that went through this process, and that's the idea of a safe room. What is a safe room in the tornado context?
Yeah, I mean, I imagine Frank can address this as an expert. I can approach it just as a layman. When I first started reporting this story, I think I had the same idea that many people have, which is that if you're in a building that winds up, right directly hit by a big tornado, it's just bad luck, and there's almost nothing you can do. And the sense that I had after reporting this story is there is actually a lot that can be done, and in particular, this idea of a safe room, which according to FEMA offers, quote, near absolute protection during a tornado. And so the idea has been, well, maybe buildings in tornado prone areas should be required to have these safe rooms. They're not cheap, cost is an issue, but they're not crushingly expensive either. I'm told that you can get smaller ones for as little as sort of $7,000 to $10,000. And so after Joplin, the proposal was made to require these safe rooms be installed in a wider range of new buildings in tornado-prone areas. And it was rejected by the International Code Council on a series of reasons, I think one being cost. But the idea kept on popping up. I think a great question is whether tornadoes like the ones that happened in December will shift that view and make people and governments more willing to impose tougher standards on the building industry, even though those standards do raise costs.
Frank, what are your thoughts on safe room requirements? And maybe you can just briefly, what would a safe room look like? What would the experience of being in a safe room during a storm feel like?
I mean, you know, the safe room specifically is a specific room that you would build in your house that would typically be, for example, reinforced concrete. It generally be in a home. It could be relatively small, maybe the size of a bathroom, but ultimately is designed to withstand both the wind loading and debris loading from tornadoes. And so, you know, these are specifically designed rooms to withstand tornado loads. So in general, the engineering is there to do it, right? Like Chris said, it's a cost thing. And then also, you had mentioned, I had served on the American Society of Civil Engineers Wind Load Committee, and specifically the Tornado Task Committee. And so what our role was really try to get tornado design into the standards, into ASCE. Now, the step from ASCE then is basically ASCE sets minimum loads for structures. And then ICC, the international codes, would then adopt ASCE loading provisions. And so when we did this exercise for tornadoes, we did realize that the risk from tornadoes is a lot higher in certain regions of the country than we had previously thought. And so in the new ASCE 7, which is the minimum design load standard, tornadoes would be included for some category of buildings. Now, this doesn't include homes. And so what we typically do in ASCE is design to a certain risk, to a certain risk level, a certain probability of failure that we accept. And it's pretty low. But in general, what we found was that tornadoes become a problem for Category 3 and Category 4 structures, which are high occupancy buildings, which generally don't include homes. So basically, we're saying that the risk of damage is higher for regular wind, non-tornado, for example, for homes, than for larger, higher occupancy buildings. And so here's where kind of the debate, and Chris wrote it in his article, where, you know, some of the debate really kind of starts between, should we require safe rooms for all homes, or should we require, for example, safe rooms for high occupancy structures like schools, warehouses, you know, for example, the Amazon warehouse in Edwardsville. And so that's where a lot of the discussion really focused on for tornado design loads, and where it really kind of continues.
Chris, where is the pressure against changing these building rules? Where is it coming from?
So in the realm of home construction, the National Association of Home Builders represents home builders and is very powerful and does a good job representing sort of the perceived interests of that sector. And they've got sort of a standard approach to these issues, at least in the years that I've been covering them, which is they tend to be pretty skeptical about code changes that will increase cost. And they have been resistant. Other groups have been resistant too. Anybody who is exposed to losing business potentially if a structure or a home gets more expensive is sort of naturally, I think, incentivized to be skeptical of these kinds of changes. I think the issue is that the counter push would come from homeowners or people who would be protected by these kinds of code changes. And I think the issue is there isn't, from what I can tell, there isn't a very good understanding yet of the degree to which the technology has improved. To Frank's point, I think the technology for safe rooms isn't even that new. It seems like for years, engineers have known how to build safe rooms that will withstand tornadoes. And even beyond safe rooms, my sense from this reporting is that the technology, including the technology that was reviewed by ASCE, for protecting structures, for helping structures avoid being destroyed by tornadoes, is pretty impressive and not actually all that complicated. But like safe rooms, building to those higher standards increases costs. So I think we're going from a point where it was just assumed that there was nothing you could do to now at least some wider understanding that there are at least options. But again, the question is, are the people who wind up paying for these buildings, whether homeowners for the sake of homes or commercial developers for commercial buildings, are they willing to absorb that higher cost? And do governments feel comfortable requiring that? And that's, you know, very much an open question.
I want to make this a little more personal. I mean, this has been a bit more of an abstract conversation so far. Frank, let me ask you, do I need a safe room in my house, right? We've got a basement, a windowless room in the basement. How safe am I should a tornado strike? Is this something that I should people be considering, not even me, but like, should people consider retrofitting their homes to put these in somehow? Or is this something that, I mean, that would be too difficult to achieve?
No, I mean, I mean, from somebody who comes from more of the science perspective, I would say it's probably not necessary for you to have a safe room in your home. If you do have a basement, you know, that's generally pretty safe in the case of a tornado. But I think more importantly is starting from the ground level. You know, do you have a safety plan for your home? Do you know the best location in your home to help you survive in the tornado? I think that's where we need to get to first, you know, and I'm doing some research with social scientists and others to try to figure out what do people do when there's a tornado bearing down, you know, what are their sheltering behaviors? And to increase survivability, we need to get that information out there. Where in your home is most safe? Make sure you have a safety plan. And again, I think that when it comes to safe rooms specifically, the cost is going to be an issue. But I think the first step is really public awareness of tornadoes and your likelihood of being impacted and what you need to do to increase your survivability in case one would happen to strike your home.
Well, then, Frank, what about in an industrial setting, right? Do you think a safe room or additional safe rooms could possibly have saved the lives of the workers in the Amazon facility in Edwardsville?
Yeah, definitely possible. I mean, I think that's, you know, and Chris mentioned it, I think these, unfortunately, you know, these kind of disasters really start asking questions, new questions or old questions that have been around for a while. And, you know, having storm shelters, real storm shelters in large industrial buildings, for example, makes a lot of sense. And, you know, for example, in Joplin, there were other tilt up construction that collapsed. So, you know, the Home Depot comes to mind, and, you know, they didn't really have a safe area to go to, even if they didn't have a storm shelter. So again, I think, you know, having a designated storm shelter that, you know, is either designed to withstand tornado loads or someplace that increases your survivability is key. So I think hopefully what comes of this is that you'll see, you know, a push for requirement of storm shelters in large warehouse facilities. And another point to that is in ASC 7 in the tornado loading, you know, size of structure is now included for tornadoes, because the larger your structure, the more likely it is to be hit by a tornado. And some of these warehouse facilities are huge. And so, you know, if you have 5, 6, 7 warehouse facilities in some area, the likelihood of any part of those getting hit by a tornado is, you know, goes up significantly. So I think that's where, you know, the push needs to be right now is for, you know, these, again, high occupancy warehouses that have, you know, 50 to 200 people in it, maybe at any given time, can really minimize lives lost.
All right, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Frank Lombardo, who's assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois. He specializes in wind engineering and building resilience. Also, New York Times reporter Christopher Flavelle, who covers how people in industry are adapting to a changing climate. We will tweet out a link to his article, which is called How the Building Industry Blocked Tornado Safeguards. Christopher, Frank, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks so much.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Before we go, I do want to urge you to join our texting group. We do ask questions of our listeners all week. We share your responses on the show. You can join by sending the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Again, just send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You can find out how to do that at our website as well. That's 21stshow.org. And while you're there, you can find links to our podcast. We're also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. That's The 21st. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer, and our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.